accidental or designed? Are we human beings just an evolutionary accident? Are we more than that? Are we less than that? Are we designed? And it's a powerfully big question. I wanted to show you what the Peninsula said by way of answer to that question, because over the last 6 months we've surveyed people to find out what they've thought, and here's roughly what they've thought. About 71% of people have said we're just an accident. We're just an evolutionary fluke. We've come about by no particular design. Of course, many more people have said other than that. About 27% have said, you know, we're either designed or we're a mixture of both of those things. Now, are you aware how big a question that is? It came up last year. It's come up this year because it's one of the issues that's on the mind of our community. And a number of people, you can see 71%, have bought into that, I think without perhaps realising what's at stake in it, if we're just an evolutionary fluke. Now, I want to pick that up for you this morning and consider some of those things, but here's what the Bible's saying about us. In the passage that Carrie just read for us a moment ago, by contrast, no, we're fearfully and wonderfully made is the Bible's point of view. Now that phrase actually from Psalm 139 that Carrie so helpfully read there a little while ago, that's written 3,000 years ago. But it tells you something very distinctive and important about the Christian view of humanity. It's actually the view that was modelled and taught by Jesus Christ. It says that every human life is the intentional creation of a good and loving God who meant us for himself, meant us for a future beyond the broken world that we live in, intends us for eternity. Now, extraordinary things, the Bible's being said. And there's the comparison of two worldviews that I'm inviting you to enter into with us this morning. That was the view that shaped the Western world, that Bible view. A view that most of you will be familiar with in some sense, even if you're not a Christian, and I'm aware many of you are here this morning and perhaps just exploring these things. It's become the basis of so many of the things that we assume in our Western society, our ethics, our legal framework, our social structures, our science and art and education and the pursuit of those things, our medical jurisprudence, and you name it. So many things all based on a view of humanity that began with that biblical idea that we're not a fluke. We're intentional. We're important. We're not mere animals whose lives simply come and go. We're the special possession of a loving creator, fearfully and wonderfully made. It's a view, can I say, that many of our friends who've bought into that alternative idea, I don't think they've quite seen the ramifications of that idea. But it'd be helpful to see that this morning. Because the particular view that the Bible's teaching implies this about you as an individual. It implies that your life is meaningful. It implies that there's a purpose to it, that you have a hope, if you understand what that hope is, that there's a dignity about you that ought to shape the way we treat you, that shapes the way we treat not just other people, actually, but the way we ought to treat animals, the way we treat the created world around us. And it's impossible to overestimate the extent to which that view, brought by the gospel of Jesus 2,000 years ago, transformed the ancient world, changed it dramatically. Up to that point, human life had been a very cheap thing in the ancient world. If human rights existed, they were only for the very privileged few, the elite of society, a few wealthy families. But for the rest, life was, a mixture of very great darkness and very great hopelessness. Removing that idea that we matter changes so much. Can you imagine it? Removing the idea and actually replacing it with the idea we're simply a biological fluke changes so much that our friends, I think, on the peninsula haven't actually seen, haven't really thought into. In America, they know the name Bill Nye. Bill Nye is a science guy in America. In fact, he made a movie last year entitled Bill Nye, Science Guy. He's kind of runs one of those big network shows on TV that talks about science and the various things of science. And here's what he said about us. His comment was, I'm just another speck of sand, and the Earth, in the cosmic scheme of things, is another speck. The Sun, another unremarkable star, is another speck. And the galaxy is a speck. And then he finished by saying, I'm a speck on a speck, orbiting a speck, among other specks, in the middle of specklessness. I suck. Now, I don't know if you can... Does that sum up your life? I mean, is that what you really think? It's an extraordinary kind of statement, isn't it? But Bill says that actually because of his belief in a revolution that took place in human thought, about 150 years ago now. It was the time when Charles Darwin published a very long-awaited book, a book that sold out on day one, a book that's never been out of print since. His book was The Origin of the Species. And Darwin was a God-believing man. He wasn't a Christian. He remained that to the end of his day, a God-believing man. But the central idea of his theory, because I realised this morning we're talking about stuff that we don't talk about that much, do we? You did it in school, didn't you? All this kind of stuff. And you're so glad you've left it behind. But most of us don't think about it or talk about it very often. Darwin's theory didn't have to do with how life began on the planet. He was actually a little bit frightened to go there. Now, his theory had to do with the way human species have developed over time and other species as well. But what was very clear about it was, from the beginning, it seemed to be in clear opposition to that long-standing view that human beings matter, that we're important, that we're significant, that we're unique and different. And although it wasn't his intent, it seemed to throw doubt on the Bible. Can you trust it anymore? Now, that might be the question people here have come this morning asking. Can you trust what the Bible says? Especially, can you trust it in the light of scientific knowledge? And a theory that life makes progress by means of death and destruction throws doubt on the idea that if there is a God, is he kind? Is he benevolent? Does he care? Does he love his creation that it's actually built on the idea of death? But of course, you realise it threw greatest doubt on the idea of human beings. So it's greatest doubt on the question of us. Where the Bible taught so clearly that human beings have got a special place in the created world, Darwin's theory appeared to clearly imply we're just another animal. We're just, we're just like a elevated cockroach. We're a slater, but we're a little bit more developed than that. We're more fortunate than most, but we're not more important. We don't have any purpose. We don't have any hope. We don't have any future. Now, can I say, just to fill you in on some stuff before we get into it, because I'm going to pray for us in a moment, Darwin understood where all this was heading. And he agonised over it, in fact. He agonised over the threat that his work posed to traditional Christian belief, which he largely believed in. He, in fact, explained in a letter to a friend, Asa Gray, an American author and a very famous man, who was a Christian himself. He said, I have no intentions to write atheistically. But among people who understood the Bible, understood where it was heading, there was an immediate reaction. And let me tell you about it way back then. The highest ranking Catholic in the land slammed Darwin's theory, slammed it, as a brutal philosophy, to the effect that there is no God and that the ape is our Adam, was his quote. One of the, the highest ranking Church of England archbishops in the land condemned it, asking one of Darwin's supporters in a very famous speech, was he related to an ape on his grandma's side or on his grandpa's side? It was that kind of very, very bitter and hostile environment. Now, can I put this in perspective for some of you? This is kind of, in our day and age, very confusing, I think. Is that right? Do you find this confusing sort of stuff? I think most of us don't understand the signs. We don't understand all the ins and outs of this. And even if everyone says it's true, we're not sure what to believe. I think that's the case for the Christian. Often not sure what to believe. And for others, there's no debate. We absolutely know what we believe. For many of you out there, you're thinking, strike, the idea of God is like a fairy story for kids to keep them, you know, quiet at night and good at Christmas time. There's nothing more to discuss. Here's what I want to raise for you this morning, though. Whether you're a Christian or not, it's possible to be blinded by your bias. Now, can I say that this morning? I think if you're a Christian, there'll be things we talk about this morning where you've got a very set view and you haven't thought lots beyond it and you don't want to think lots beyond it. And actually, if I can put it this way, if you're not a Christian, it might be exactly the same. You've heard things at school, you assume they're true, you haven't really looked into them yourself, but you've got a very firm view. Can I say this for you if you're a Christian? The Bible is claiming to be God-given, but it's not claiming that your interpretations of it are God-given. So bear that in mind this morning. I just might unsettle you a little bit. Likewise, if you're a person who takes your stand on the claims of science, now I've got a background in science, so that's been the area of my study for many, many years. You need to be very careful to distinguish between the facts of evolution on the one hand and the rhetoric of naturalism on the other hand. You know what I mean by naturalism? It's a whole philosophy of where human beings have come from and where everything's come from. That is, distinguish between good science and assumed philosophy. That's a point that's made very clear by a really famous American geneticist, actually, a man named Richard Lewontin, Lewontin is his name sometimes pronounced. He's a man who believes in evolution. But in a very candid interview, here's what he said. He said, "We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories." And now he tells you why. Very important to grasp before we get into this morning. Because we have a prior commitment to materialism. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Now, hear what that man's saying? I think it's actually very candid that he's put it that way. But I don't want to misquote him, and I don't want to quote him unfairly out of context. What Richard is saying is really simple. He's saying that, in his view, scientists are trained to look for naturalistic explanations. They're looking for explanations that don't provide any mystical explanation of how things have come about. No idea of God. They're just looking for evidence. And which means, as Richard Dawkins complains, if you're looking for some sort of God view, you may well overlook the evidence. But here's the flip side problem of that. If you're just looking for scientific evidence, if you're just looking for naturalistic evidence, sometimes you'll ignore the evidence that points in the opposite direction to the way you want it to point, such that you won't allow any alternative explanation and you won't admit any failure of the evidence. Now, there's the little problem we're dealing with. Let me bring you back to the point before I pray for us. We've all got a bias. You might not have realised that before. If you're a Christian, you've got a bias. If you're an atheist, you've got a bias, especially on this topic, because what lies behind the topic we're looking at this morning is nothing less than the question of, is there a creator God? Is there someone to whom I need to give my adherence? Is there someone I need to listen to? Is there someone who knows better about my life than I do? So I'm going to pray this morning for you. I'm praying for you if you're a Christian, that you might be able to put aside your bias for a moment. I'm praying for you if you're an evolutionist, that you can put aside your bias for a moment and think open-mindedly with us on this issue, and that I can speak clearly about it. Let me do that very quickly. Our Heavenly Father, I do want to ask this morning for us whether we're outsiders to these things, or we're firm believers in a biblical view of these things, whether we're firmly entranced with the scientific view of these things. Help us, Father, to be open-minded. Help us to think about these things clearly. Help us to listen carefully, to ask good questions. And Father, help me to speak clearly this morning, and not in a way that bores us. Help me to be succinct. And I want to pray that in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Well, got where we're going? I reckon I'm going to stop part of the way through and ask questions, because I want to be as clear as I can and don't want to lose any of you. Here's two questions that I want to take up. What does the Bible teach about human origins? What does it actually teach? Not necessarily what's the view that you've grown up believing, but what does it actually teach? And secondly, how compelling is the evidence for evolution? Where are we with that kind of at the moment? Because what you'll find is that's changed substantially over the last 40 years. Take the first question first. What does the Bible really say about human origins? What does it say about where we've come from? And I hope you get the significance of the question. Well, it tells a very consistent story. And Genesis, carefully understood, is still the best place to see it. And I want to invite you, take out that sheet of paper from which Carrie read. I'm going to take you through that really quickly this morning. If it looks like a lot of print on there, and it is, don't worry, I'm not going to bog you down in it. But it begins with that statement that's so familiar to so many of us. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And it continues with an easily overlooked statement that I want to draw your attention to. It says, "Now the earth was formless and empty." Now I'm going to come back to that little point for you, because I wonder if you've just kind of flashed over that before and not seen the significance of it. But when you read any literature, you guys all read books, don't you? Do you know? It's Christmas holidays, you get some time away from the kids, hopefully you send them off and they're at a party and you've got time to sit down and read a book. When you read any kind of literature, you do something intuitively. You do something without even thinking about it, that ironically many people tend not to do when they come to the Bible. Here's what you do. You subconsciously take account of the kind of literature that you're reading. Just subconsciously. You do it without even thinking about it. In the Sunday comics, if you still get the Sunday paper, you don't read Hagar the Horrible, you know, in exactly the same way as you read Banjo Patterson, do you know? If you ever read poetry or anything like that. You don't read Mills and Boone in the same way as you read that history book you got when you were at school. You don't read Banjo Patterson the same way as you read Spiro Zavos's rugby column. You know, you read those things differently because they're different styles of literature. Now, friends, with that in mind, I don't want to bore you, stick with me on this one. With that in mind, there's a pattern in this passage that's actually hard to miss. And I wonder if you've missed it. Let me take you on in the passage, because you pick up there sentence number 3, and God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Familiar to you, this stuff? God saw that the light was good. He separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, the darkness he called night, and there was evening and there was morning the first day. 7 days altogether. The seventh one caps it off. 6 days that follow this regular pattern. And this regular pattern got 7 parts. With me so far? Got 7 parts. Here they are. And God said, "Let there be," and it was so. And God saw, and he called them, and there was evening and morning, the first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day, etc., etc. There's a pattern in that. And actually, when you read it, like when you read a comic, when you read a piece of poetry, you're meant to see the pattern. Did you see the pattern before? Or are you seeing it now for the very first time? It's not quite poetry, that, but it's kind of on that spectrum. It's on the spectrum of literature that's highly stylized. It's designed to tell you something about this God and his work. It's like a regular drumbeat. Bang, 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 and then it repeats. It's like a regular drumbeat. And it tells you something about this God. He's orderly, he's powerful, he's good, and he's intentional. He's moving toward an end with monotonous almost, with almost mechanical ease, moving toward the point of a deliberate goal which comes on the sixth day, because having created the other animals, he then pauses, sentence 26, see how quick we move through that? You're over the page, onto the other side. Sentence 26, he stops, does something very unusual. He confers within himself and he says, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds in the sky. Now, the fact that there's something plural about God, that's unusual. But here's the key point I wanted to draw to your attention. It's the place of humanity in his creation. Something's been deliberately set in that whole pattern there. We're the apex. We're God-like human beings. We've got a responsibility to rule. We're carefully provided for. You'll see in those verses that follow, sentence 29, which I won't take you into this morning. But I wonder if you noticed an oddity that struck me in this passage. The very first time I read this as an 18, 19-year-old kid who was studying medicine at university and thinking about all things scientific. And when I read this passage, the thing that struck me is that odd thing which I drew to your attention if you were with us last year. Remember day one? Remember what happened on day one? What happened on, what did God create day one? Cast your mind back there. It was the light and the dark, remember? Yeah. And the odd little thing that struck me on that was that when does the sun, moon and stars, when do they get created? Scan down and you'll find it. Where is it? Not day two. Not day three. Not even before that. It's day four. How odd is that? How odd that the light and the dark come day one and the sun, moon, stars, the things that actually give it, come on day two. And that's when I realised that the author's given you his clue. He gave you his clue in sentence number two. He gave you the clue to the pattern that he was putting together for you. Remember what verse 2 said? The earth was formless and empty. Formless and empty. And what you see on those next bunch of days is God creates the forms and he fills them. That's what's going on in this passage. You may not have read it that way before. You might want to come and argue with me afterwards. But I want to show you there's something more going on here that's a bit more sophisticated than perhaps you thought before. Day one, created the light and the dark. Day two, he created the oceans and the skies. Day three, he created the land and the vegetation. Day four, he filled the light and the dark. Day five, he filled the oceans and the skies. Day six, he filled the land. Something a bit more sophisticated is going on there than I think lots of people realise. Now, what's that got to do with that whole issue we're talking about this morning, that whole evolutionary issue we're talking about? Well, firstly, let me give you a suggestion about this chapter. It's most likely not designed to teach you how long it took God to create. Most likely, there's something much more sophisticated going on in that. Not interested in that, is my suggestion. Not aiming to tell you the order in which he did it. Not aiming to tell you the age of the earth, not aiming to tell you when Adam and Eve lived, not aiming to tell you where the dinosaurs came from and where they actually came in. I know some of us differ here, but Genesis is mostly interested not in telling you about time. It's mostly interested in telling you about God. Mostly interested in telling you about him. Guess what it's telling you about him? With that regular, orderly drumbeat. Bang. bang, bang. What do you think it's telling you about him? He's orderly. He's intentional. He's powerful. He's the subject of every line, moving toward a goal with great intention. I think there's the first thing it's meant to tell you about. Not aiming to tell you about time. It'd be my modest suggestion about that. Here's the second thing. It's also highly interested in telling you about us. Telling you about us as human beings. Because human beings in this account are the ones who take pride of place in God's affections. Hence the deliberate pattern. Hence we appear at the high point. We appear on the same day as the animals because we're like them, but we're very different from them. In fact, you haven't got Genesis chapter 2 there, but if you do, flip open to Genesis chapter 2 for a moment. You won't find it on your piece of paper. And if you haven't, just remember it, because in Genesis chapter 2, remember what you get? Well, kind of you get another view of creation. You kind of get another creation story. Now, it's not because the author is so dumb that he forgot he wrote one in chapter 1 and he just figured he'd do another one in chapter 2. It's actually because he gives you a zoom in on what he's already done in chapter 1. He zooms in on the creation events and he tells you now about human beings particularly. And one of the little odd things you find is chapter 2, the order of some things is different. Why is that? That the order in chapter 2 is different to in chapter 1. For example, in chapter 2, the vegetation comes after the animals. When did the vegetation come in chapter 1? It came on day 6. After the animals. But actually in chapter 2, it comes in a whole different order. Likewise, the trees in chapter 1, they appeared to come just fully grown, bang. End of that day, there were trees there. That's not what you see in chapter 2. What you see in chapter 2 is they haven't yet grown yet because the rain hasn't come yet. Well, there's an unusual thing. And here's the point, I think, to draw from it. Because I don't want to lose you. We're going to stop in a moment. You can pick up questions. Here's what's happening in chapter 2. It's telling you at least in chapter 2 that God in his creation seems to have used naturalistic processes. He used the rain to make the rain came, use the naturalistic rain to make the trees grow. You didn't see that in chapter 1, you do see it in chapter 2. And it says this, don't attach too great an understanding to the literal reading of the text. I'm not saying do away with it, I'm saying there's something bigger going on in that passage than simply a blow-by-blow Sydney Morning Herald description of what God's done. But one reality you find repeated, whether first chapter or the second one, is the unique significance of you. The unique significance of human beings like you. Because again, in sentence 7 of chapter 2 there, human creation is personal, it's intimate. God forms the man out of dust. He breathes into his nostrils. Now, are you meant to conclude that God's got lungs and a mouth? You know, that he breathes into their nostrils the breath of life? I don't think so. And I don't think you think so. I don't think that's the point at all. You're just meant to take away that human beings are uniquely created. We've got a spiritual nature. We're shaped to relate to God. Now, what do you conclude from all this about human origins? Well, let me draw a couple of conclusions and then throw it open to you for questions. First thing I'd suggest is the Bible is ruling out the idea that human beings are simply the product of mindless evolution from lower life forms. I think it's ruling that idea out. I think it's saying we're more than that. Now, I know some Christians oppose that idea and they have their reasons for doing it. I personally think they're mistaken, but I'm interested to listen to their reasoning on it. Not to mention, I think the logic of the Bible argues against that idea. I think it's saying that Adam was a real man. He was unique. He's distinct from the animals. He's designed with a purpose and a goal and an intention. Now, there's the first thing I think you see from that account. Here's the second one. It's that in shaping his creation, God could easily have made use of evolutionary processes. You think that's beyond him? Not at all. He made use of biological processes to make the trees grow. He made use of geological processes to make the valleys and the mountains. He made use of chemical processes to make the sun, the moon, and the stars. Could he have used evolution to shape his creation? Absolutely. Can't see any reason why he wouldn't have done. In fact, I think there's very good evidence that he did. So you don't want to be biased at that point. You don't want to be needlessly biased at that point. Genesis may seem to be written in just kind of simple, childlike terms, but I tell you what, friends, it's not childish. Not childish. Highly sophisticated. Perhaps more sophisticated than you'd realised before. It's teaching truths about us that for centuries we've known intuitively. That you know in the depths of your heart, wherever you are with these things, you know it. You're not like a dog and a cat. You're not like a rabbit. You know, you don't see dogs and cats down, you know, the local street corner talking philosophy, you know, pondering the meaning of life. You don't see them having those kind of conversations, but you see those things all the time in us. We're fundamentally different. This is what the Bible's been saying from the outset. I'm going to suggest to you that's what the best of evidence will suggest as well. Now, there's the first question. There's the first question. I think the second one will be very much shorter. But I'm going to stop. I'm going to see if you want to ask questions because I don't want to lose you. And I know this is kind of heady stuff and it's not what we normally do here on a Sunday. So, questions you want to ask? Aaron.
Craig, can you please define what you mean by evolution?
Yeah, I'm going to do that in a moment. Yeah, because it could mean three things. Yeah, so good question. Got others? It's all a bit dizzying, isn't it? Yeah, Carrie. Carrie's always got a question. She's great at thinking up questions. Yeah.
That's a lot of pressure, Craig. So you talked about how, you know, God could use naturalistic processes to create the world, and perhaps he did so. Sometimes it seems as though that kind of idea has this has a connotation of God kind of starting the ball rolling and yep. then stepping back.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean? That he sort of starts things going, that he hasn't been intimately involved in, you know, how orangutans are different to gorillas, or how, you know, the difference both between species as well as, you know, in the way that things have continued on?
No. I don't mean that. I mean in the sense that, you know, rain comes, an earthquake occurs, a child is born. They're naturalistic processes, aren't they? But it doesn't absolve God from his involvement in them. What's being said about God is he's great enough to be involved in and through the naturalistic world he's created. That he allows those processes to take place doesn't mean he's taken his hands off the wheel, he's gone whoops, you know. He can simply use those as he actually, as you hear this morning, some of you are thinking, where am I in Christian life? I don't know that I buy it, but I'm interested to hear the answers. Well, God is not going to bypass your mind. That's the very mind he's made. He'll work through it to bring you to a better conclusion. Those two things aren't mutually exclusive. Yeah, hope that was clear. Now we've got lots of questions, huh? So the lady with the microphone's Lee, yeah.
Hi. People who play games have probably heard the name Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
So isn't this just one story, and there are other stories about how the world started and who's in charge or if anyone's in charge?
Wow, we're educated people down here on the peninsula, aren't we? Yeah, Gilgamesh is an ancient Mesopotamian creation narrative. But very, very different. And there were a number of those kind of creation narratives. Enuma Elish is another one of those. And there are a number of those around in the ancient world. Very different, though, from the view that the Bible is giving here. In fact, without prolonging this, Genesis, I think, is written with those creation stories in mind, and it's giving a very different view. The Gilgamesh idea, for example, is about the battle between gods. And as a result, the byproduct of that, human beings appear as slaves. They're actually made from the blood of the entrails of the gods who fought and one of them lost, and that's where we came from. Very different view. And at every point, Genesis is saying, no, it was actually like this. It was the intentional result of a good God. So, yeah, thanks, Lee, for the question. Yep. Yep, Carlos.
I have a question about the question is, or the answers that people were saying about our existence. If people use the language, we are an accident of a fluke, or we are assuming that they say that. Because I live my work is more in the atheist world and scientist world and evolutionist world, and people who are in academia or in that area, I never heard that language. I heard
a more. Let me stop you there for just a second. They have heard that language. They are aware of that language, and they have an answer to it. So keep going.
Yeah. So my question is: if people are saying we are just the word "just" an accident, or we are a fluke, if people are really saying that, this is a question because yeah. I haven't heard it like that. I heard that language from us, Christians and creationists, talking about them, but I haven't heard it much from them. So this is a question.
You haven't heard it. So to repeat that, are we accidental or designed? That language was very common, actually, a number of years ago. Can you imagine why the atheist doesn't want to go for the idea that we're accidental? Makes us look like a fluke. Just makes us look like a dumb accident. Yes, it has actually been common language in the past. And I want to suggest there's a alternative argument that's come from the evolutionary world to say, no, accidental mutations occur, yes, selected carefully by nature in some fashion to enable something that looks like and resembles design to take place. I just want to make the point, the inescapable fuel for evolution is accidental genetic mutation. It's random, completely random at that point. And at that point, completely accidental. So in one sense, it's, according to the evolutionary view, it's a complete miracle that we've taken, that human life's actually ever evolved on this planet at all. In fact, the evolutionary answer to that is, there might just be millions of universes and we just live on the one universe where it's happened. So there's a deeper thing behind what Carlos is asking there, but he's asking about that Christian rhetoric, accidental. And I'm suggesting, I think the atheistic world has changed the narrative on that because they want to say it's more than just accident. And I'm saying at its root, there is something just accidental in it. Gotcha.
It would be very hard to have a conversation.
Yes. Yeah, so Carlos is talking about communication there. So Christians communicating with your atheistic friends, if you don't want to stir them up, don't use that language. Fair enough?
Yeah, because it's not a language.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, and I think it's a helpful point. Greg, I'm going to have to hold it there for a moment, but I know it, and I'll come back at the end. Okay, just don't want us to lose the thread. Are you with me so far? Are you alert? Unless you've been on Summerfest all week and you're just dog tired. Let me come back to that second question. The second question is the question, what is the evidence for our evolutionary origins? How strong is it? And immediately that raises the question that Aaron brought up. What do you mean by, when a school teacher uses that word evolution, what do they mean by it? Now, I've been a school science teacher. It's one of my several careers. Now, it could be one of three things. When some people speak about evolution, they just mean that organisms which exist today are different from the ones that existed in the past. And you can think of all sorts of ways in which we're different, can't you? We live longer. Older people in this congregation continually tell me, You know, whenever we talk about how long we've got left to live, they say, no, they're thinking they're going to live until, like, what is it? 100? 90? We live much longer than we ever used to live. We're taller. We understand more things. Is that evolution? Now, some of those things are just the result of diet. Some of them are the result of technology. It's not evolution in that kind of typical Darwinian sense of the word. So there's one thing that people mean when they talk about evolution. Good to get that one out of the way. Here's the second one. Evolution can mean today just that the highly varied species that exist today have come about as a result of genes from organisms, the kind of stuff Carlos was talking about, that lived in the past, that mutated, they were passed on, they resulted in all sorts of different sorts of species today. You've heard that story, haven't you? You know about all that kind of thing. You did it in school. Like Blinky, the three-eyed fish on the Simpsons episode, you know? He's a mutation. Where did he come from? Well, he's come from some sort of gene that's changed. And again, friends, that's entirely uncontroversial. I mean, if you're a Christian, you're saying that doesn't occur, you've got your head in the sand. That's actually scientific fact. It's well understood. We call it adaptation of species. Very well understood scientific idea. It's what Darwin, Charles Darwin, first observed on that classic journey he did in the Beagle, where he formulated his special theory of evolution. Nothing controversial about that. There's a second thing people mean. But when most of us think about evolution, I reckon you've probably got a picture in your heads, haven't you? Think back to, can you do this? Can you think back to those days in the science lab at school and the picture that you saw on the science lab wall of that whole tree of life and life begins in some small ancient warm pond and whatever happened in that pond gave rise to something else that gave rise to something else that gave rise to birds and gave rise to, well, actually fish before birds and then apes and then eventually human beings. There's a whole branching tree of life. That's actually what we classically mean and what Darwin actually meant, with the exception of the beginnings there from the small pond. That's what we typically mean by evolution. Is there good evidence for that idea? Now, it's worth noting that Charles Darwin never speculated much about origins. He didn't want to go there. He didn't really want to go to the warm pond idea and spend any time thinking about that. That idea came with the discovery of genetics that took place about 50 years, 40 years after Darwin, perhaps a little less than that. And it sounds elegant and simple and plausible. In fact, I think as a theory, it's a beautiful, beautiful theory. All that stuff goes far beyond Charles Darwin, though. Can it alone explain our origins? There's the question I'm asking for you this morning. Can it alone explain our origins? And on present theories, I've got to tell you the answer is no. On present theories, that can't explain our origins. And the biggest problem is, well, actually not perhaps the biggest, but one of the biggest problems is that. It's the problem of time. Now, you'll all have different ideas. How long has the Earth been around for? You'll all have different ideas. And some of you will think it's just a number of thousands of years. You know the current theory about how long the Earth's been around for? Hands up for that one. No, too embarrassing, because it's so long since you've done science. About 4.5 billion years. That's how long they're saying the Earth's been around for. Now, you might argue with that. I'm not going to argue with it this morning. The problem is, in just simple evolutionary terms, based on random processes that we were talking about before, that's actually not long enough. You might think that's a heck of a long time. It's actually not long enough. Let me explain for you. During the 150 years that have gone by since Charles Darwin explained that whole scientific theory of his, our scientific knowledge has just escalated. It's grown out of sight. We've discovered that life's far more complex than Charles Darwin ever thought it was. And the mechanisms behind it exceed anything we ever imagined. So how did we get to this point with all the diversity of life that we've got just by random genetic trial and error, mutation and selection in just 4.5 billion years? That's the question. Now here's the answer. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. In fact, the best hope for evolutionary scientists is that life's come from somewhere out in space, not from here. It's come here by means of spores, because every good scientist knows 4.5 billion years, that's just not long enough. Pick something as simple as your eye. In The Origin of the Species, Darwin agonised over the problem of your eye, because he recognised the problem that something as flawless and complex, to quote him, could have been formed by natural selection, he said, seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. Now, of course, we know much more than Charles Darwin knew. Some say it could have just formed by evolutionary processes. Here's the point, we've got no evidence for it. No evidence whatsoever. Richard Dawkins would say, evolution must have done it, because after all we know we've got eyes, so where else could it have come from? But see what's happening there? There's a circular reasoning in that. If he's honest, he'd admit that what's speaking there is not scientific evidence at all. It's what that man Richard Lewontin was talking about before. It's his prior commitment to materialistic philosophy to say, because we've got it, it must have come from there. No divine foot allowed in the door. Now, it's a similar idea, actually, with something as simple as, when was the last time you bled? Yesterday? Today? Some people on team have been bleeding all week, I reckon. The clotting of your blood is a 20-step chemical cascade. 20 steps. One error in either of two little genes on your X chromosome, the one you get from your mum, and you end up being a bleeder, a haemophiliac. You've heard about those, yeah? Which means in the past you never would have survived with haemophilia. So how did simple genetic mutation get all those steps right by sheer trial and error in the very short period of time, not to mention the other complex systems we have in our body? No one knows. That's a biological miracle. It's incredible. After all, get the point. Imagine you're a fish with gills. I realise that's a stretch this morning, right? You know, but imagine you're a fish. You got gills. And in the genes that you pass on to your children, God forbid, you pass on the gene for lungs instead of gills. There's no such gene that does that. So how do you get from gills to lungs in one step? That never happens. In actual fact, what you get if you've got gills and you've got a genetic mutation is you end up with gills that don't work. You end up with gills that die. You know, if you got one little genetic mutation like the kid I taught a number of years ago, cystic fibrosis, just from one little genetic abnormality. So, like, we got no evidence for how we get from those things. Looks good in the diagram you saw on the science teaching wall. Actually, it's a little bit more sophisticated than that. That's not the biggest problem. Time's not the biggest problem. Well, actually, perhaps in a way it is. The biggest problem is this. It's the problem of self-replication. Now, this is really intense stuff, isn't it? I'm almost done. And the biggest problem is that. How did life, even one little cell, less complex than you see in the little tadpole pool that your kids go fishing in the bush, how did that even get started on its own in the beginning? And how did it learn to divide and make more of itself than that? Back in the 1950s, we thought we knew. Back in the 1950s, it all seemed so simple. Back in the 1950s, we thought it all started in some shallow little pond. In the ancient world, with some random chemicals floating around, was struck by a bolt of lightning, it formed the first complex molecules. It seemed so simple, it seemed so obvious. We thought we'd replicate it in an experiment in America. Guess what? All that changed 50 years ago. Changed back in the 1970s when we realised what it takes to make one tiny, uncomplicated little cell work. 50 years ago, we unravelled that whole strand of DNA. Remember hearing about that stuff? We unravel all that stuff. You've been hearing about it for the last, you know, number of years, and we saw how that DNA strand codes for protein in every component in the body, how many proteins there are, how many subunits there are in a DNA assembly, and how many you need put together in exactly the right order to make those proteins work, about 3.5 billion of them, can you believe it, to make you function. All assembled by intricate machines that already existed inside the cell. Are you dying? Is the biology killing you? I'm just about done. All designed in advance to construct that stuff to make you, to make the simplest cell work. When we realise that, when we realise that with a shock, we realise that simple trial and error causing that to happen with no intelligent direction, the chances of that are effectively zero. So incomprehensibly small that, as I said before, most scientists have given up the idea that life just evolved by natural causes on Earth. They've pushed it off into outer space, hoping that you can say it's come here from spores from another planet. And that gives you a few more billion years to play with. Because even if you did create that stuff just by some fluke, guess what? Then you've got another problem. Because now you've got a DNA code. You know what the problem is? Imagine the code that works the combination lock on your, you know, bicycle, and no one knows what the combination is anymore. You know, now you've got a code with no one to break it. Well, there's the problem. Imagine you've got a DNA code and nothing to actually unravel it. Let me bring you to the point and sum this up for you. It's a bald mathematical fact that a code like that requires intelligence. Requires an intelligence to create it, requires an intelligence to activate it, requires an intelligence to start it in the first instance. Evolution can never supply that. It's a wonderful theory, wonderful, that may well explain something of the mechanism by which God's created diversity on the earth, but it can't explain our origins. We're a very long way scientifically from being able to do that. Can't explain the complexity of human beings. Can't explain why you love justice. Can't explain why you crave meaning, why you delight in beauty, why you ponder eternity, why you have a sense of hope, or at least you want a sense of hope. Can't explain those things at all. Can't explain why we want to worship. But the Bible can. The Bible explains it thoroughly, beautifully, wonderfully. Do you really suck? To make all this really simple and, you know, make it really simple. Are you really just a speck on a speck, orbiting other specks in the middle of specklessness? You can hold that view on the basis of philosophy, but you can't hold on the basis of evidence. We have some good evidence for evolution, just that we're missing a whole bunch on it. 3,000 years ago, that Old Testament psalmist, in a hymn of praise, wrote this about human life: I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. They're words about a designer, a creator God who cares about us, who made us spiritual like himself. We're talking about that next week. And Jesus is the one who introduces you to that God. He says that you owe him. He says that you desperately need his forgiveness. He says that you're not truly human without him. He says that the life you live in the absence of him is just barely existence. It's not what he's intended you for. And you will never have it until you actually come to him and receive it. And friends, I want to say to you, that is a truth worth investigating. That's a truth worth investigating. And I want to invite you to do that. I want to invite you to make a start in your Peninsula News that you got as you came in. Some of you will be able to hold it up there. You've got that card for life. Well, I want to invite you, think about coming along to that. No pressure from us. We want to be able to answer the big questions. It's why we're doing this series So next week we're picking up the question, are we spiritual or just plain physical? But in your Peninsula News as well, you've got a little card there. And if you'd like to come to that, in about a month's time, put your name on the card. You can actually write something else on there. You'd like to find out more about church. Stick it in the box down the back. We'd love to get you as much help as you need or as little help as you want. I'm done. What have we got? It's really, really late, isn't it? Shay, can I take a couple of questions? Can you survive through a couple of questions? Do you want to go to morning tea? Just put up your hand if you want to ask a couple of questions. Okay. And I'll be super quick. And if we've got to stop, we'll stop and go do morning tea.
Hey, Craig, I just went I know some people talk about like intelligent, like an intelligent universe or something like that.
Intelligent design?
Yeah. I guess explaining that, because I guess that's sort of like another, I guess, theory that people sort of latch onto.
Intelligent design is a movement that arose 10 or 15 years ago, and I think it's a helpful movement. But here's what you don't want to do as a Christian, if I can put it this way. You don't want to pin your hopes to the idea that there are gaps that science can't explain. You don't want to pin your hopes to that, because actually science, you know, we can explain more and more things than we ever have done before. What I've given you this morning is not a God of the gaps thing. It's saying there are some things that science can never explain. It requires an intelligence, whereas I think the intelligent design movement is a bit of a God of the gaps thing. It's made some very helpful observations. Just don't pin your hopes to it. Yep. Yeah. Got others? I answered your one, Aaron. Is that what we mean by evolution? Good one. I think we're done. Come see me over morning tea if there's more to ask. We're going to celebrate these things together by singing. I want to invite you to do that with real joy.